Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. And today, for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guest is Matthew Teller. Matthew is a journalist, a writer, and a broadcaster, and he recently published a wonderful and an amazing book, and I just want to start with this introduction, Nine Quarters of Jerusalem. Nine Quarters of Jerusalem is a new biography of the Old City. And essentially, with Matthew, we're going to delve into some of his chapters discussing the history, but more importantly, connecting the history of the Old City with the contemporary events that are literally unfolding as of now in Jerusalem. Now, before we discuss all about Jerusalem and this new biography of the Old City, Matthew, welcome.
Thanks so much, Roberto. It's great to be here.
Matthew, the first question I want to ask you, if you can tell us a little bit about your background, and also, why did you feel the need to write a new book about Jerusalem?
That's interesting. Well, yeah, my background is, as you said in your very generous introduction, I'm an author and a journalist and a broadcaster. I started in travel writing. So back when I was in my 20s, I was traveling around, as you tend to do, and using guidebooks of the day. And one of the guidebooks I was using when I was in Morocco, I remember, was The Rough Guide to Morocco. And as I was going around with my girlfriend at the time, we could see that, you know, some of the information is out of date. The hotel is closed or a new restaurant has opened. So when I got back, I wrote a letter in two rough guides. This was in letter days. This was pre-email. And I said to them, how does it work? How does somebody write for you? Are they staff? Are they freelance? How does it work? And the author of that book wrote back to me with some guidelines. You know, I also supplied some information for the book about different places that had opened or closed since the last edition. And he was very supportive. And he said, write in to the office in London and talk to this guy. And if they're interested, they'll take you on. So I did, and they asked me to write, I remember actually this was in the 90s, they asked me to write 1,000 words about a place that I knew well. And back then I chose Jerusalem as well. So I wrote them in 1,000 words about Jerusalem, which they liked. And then they commissioned me. So I wrote a couple of updates for them. And then I was commissioned to write a new book, The Rough Guide to Jordan. That was in the late 90s, and I went to Jordan, lived there for a while, and wrote that book from scratch. And then it kind of snowballed from there. So I was also involved in travel writing for the UK papers and for magazines and different media outlets. And since then, I've kind of shifted. I still do some travel writing. I still have connections with Rough Guides as well, but I've kind of shifted a bit. I've done some work for BBC Radio, producing and presenting documentaries. As you said, just in the last period, sort of around the pandemic, I had finished writing this manuscript for this book about Jerusalem. So why did I feel the need, you said, to write a new book? There were many different answers to that. The answer that I'm going to go with first is a personal one. I've been very lucky in my life to have been traveling and visiting and seeing Jerusalem for years and years and years. The first time that I went was in 1980, which is a very long time ago. I was 11 years old on a family holiday. And I still, even now, I have sort of some memories, some images and some thoughts that I, the emotions, feelings that I remember from being in Jerusalem at that time when I was a young child. Shortly after that, in 1982, when I was 13, my father had the idea to give me my bar mitzvah twice. So the first bar mitzvah that I had was in the synagogue that we used as a family at home in London. And then he gave me a second option for a bar mitzvah as well, which was at the Western Wall in Jerusalem. And I also remember that as well, a very, very hot day. And I remember the stress and the tension of being there and trying to perform, to recite these pieces that I had to recite. But since then, I've been very lucky that to be going back and back and back and back. We had some family friends. There were other family connections as well. And all through my 20s and 30s and 40s, I've been going back to Jerusalem over and over and over. And I've had the chance to sort of use the city as a, how would you put it, as a benchmark from which to measure my own changes in identity and changes in sense of myself. And there were various different reasons why I wanted to write this book. Part of it is that over all that period, I could see a number of discrepancies between how Jerusalem is experienced by people like me, by tourists, by pilgrims, by visitors, outsiders, discrepancies between how it's experienced and the reality of the city, how it really is. One of those is to do with the quarters of the city, which we can maybe come to later, these the idea of four quarters, that the old city of Jerusalem within its medieval walls is divided on maps and in guidebooks and literature and news items and everything into four quarters: Muslim quarter, Christian quarter, Jewish quarter, Armenian quarter. And those very hard divisions didn't match up to reality that I could see. And I'm happy to talk about that later as well. Another reason was that I could see that people like me, like I said, tourists and pilgrims, would be coming to Jerusalem with, and I don't think this is unique to Jerusalem. I think this is common to touristed cities all over the place, but they were coming with a tick box. So people were coming with the idea of, I'm here in order to pray at the church. I'm here in order to visit the mosque. I'm here in order to kiss the Western Wall, whatever it may be. And I could see how people were interacting with the communities of Jerusalem that, in a sense, lay between them and their holy place. So people would arrive, they would exert huge amounts of energy and resources and time and effort and money to come to Jerusalem, and they would see their holy place so close. But then it's not a museum. Jerusalem is not an empty place. It's full. It's full of life, and it's full of different communities, and people who are making their business, people who are going to school, people who are whatever, they're praying or they're working or whatever. It's a living city, and visitors like people like me were seeing the people who live and work inside the walls of the old city as an impediment. They were treating them, as I could see, with either with a sort of degree of disrespect or with a degree of impatience. You know, why are you here? Why are you in the way? Why are you trying to sell me something when I'm trying to fulfill the journey of a lifetime and get to the holy place that I want to get to? So none of that seemed right to me, obviously. And I wanted to try and think of ways that I could approach that kind of mentality or that kind of outlook on Jerusalem, and to undermine it and to restore, if you like, a sense of balance, to restore the idea that the people whose lives and pasts and futures are embodied in the holy places of Jerusalem are important, and they should be celebrated as being important. So I wanted to use the platform that I've been able to develop as a writer, as a journalist, to amplify the voices of the people who live and work inside the walls of the old city. That was a strong motivation for me to write this new book.
We will certainly talk about the question of the quarters, which is a fascinating one. But let me start with the introduction of your book. Now, the introduction is essentially calls the city a city of iceberg. And I found it a very, very fascinating analogy. And basically, you present how others see the city. And I was wondering about your view, and you already said a few things about it, but what is your general feeling about Jerusalem?
That's a tough question though, Roberto. What's my general feeling? My general feeling is Jerusalem is, and I don't think this is going to be news to anybody, is an extraordinarily tense place to be. All these different communities and all the different the histories, religious and political and social and economic, that clash in this very, very, very small place, this small area. I should say that, you know, inside the walls of the old city, it's only about 1 square kilometer. It's not a big place at all. All of these histories and all these different streams crash together, if you like. It's a place which is very confusing and very difficult for outsiders to understand. One of the things that I found very instructive, actually, when I was thinking about the book and researching the book was I was very lucky to do a trip. It was a trip around Jordan, actually, with a friend of mine from Canada who is blind. And we traveled together for a week or so. And it was fascinating to be with him. I was going to say to see, but I was watching him as he traveled, but to be with him as he traveled and to understand what travel was for him, what new places meant to him, and how he was able to get under the surface, if you like, of a new place that he would just be visiting fresh. And it made me realize, which I don't think is going to be news to anybody, but we rely on our eyes too much. And particularly in the context of Jerusalem, one of the things that I harp on in the book is the idea that whatever you're seeing in front of you is not the truth of what's actually going on. So I try to evoke Jerusalem with our other senses as well, with touch, with smell, with hearing, to try and also taste as well, to try and deconstruct a little bit that reliance on sight that sighted people always do. The way that my blind friend in Jordan would understand places was fascinating. We went to a particularly beautiful part of northern Jordan. It's a place near it's near a place called Umm Qais up in the northern hills, and it's a historical site. So you know, there was a certain degree of explaining the Roman history and the Byzantine history of the place, the ruins, you know, that we were in. But also, it's a very beautiful natural site. So we took a break sitting. We did a walk into the countryside. We took a break sitting on a hillside. Drinking tea, and I was able to see this extraordinary view of this beautiful landscape of wildflowers and hills going across this incredible valley scene across to the Sea of Galilee over the border in northern Israel. And we could see Palestine, and we could see Syria, and we could, you know, from some places you can also see the mountains, the snowy mountains, just on the edge of where Lebanon is as well. But there's no point saying all of that to somebody who can't see it. How do you get across to a person who can't see the beauty of that landscape and the depth and variety of the natural scene of these wildflower meadows and the hills in front of you? It's very difficult to do. Well, the people that we were with in Jordan, one of our guides was a specialist guide who has worked a lot with people who are blind. And he took us to a beekeeper just around the corner in sort of a few minutes away from where we were sitting. And as part of that visit, as well as coming close to the hives and putting on the protective gear and actually sort of handling the hives, which helped to bring another level of reality through to my friend as well. We also tasted honey. So we were tasting 4 different kinds of honey from the bees in different, you know, that were visiting different parts of these wildflower meadows. And some of the honey was very light and floral, and some of it was rich and deep, and some of it was kind of bland and medium, and some of it was thick, and some of it was not thick, and some of it was whatever. There were different varieties of honey, and by tasting, by adding that new depth to his understanding of the place that we had just been in, he was able to gain even more depth of understanding. And by the end, it felt like, you know, he knew the place at least as well as I did, and in some ways much better than I did, even though I've been visiting for years with my eyes open and seeing everything. So that's a very long-winded story, but to try and relate that, that was very instructive for me when I was writing this book about Jerusalem. But to try and relate that to the Jerusalem context, the understanding of what you're seeing in front of you when you're in Jerusalem doesn't come through your eyes alone. It comes through a deeper sense of humanity, if you like. And part of that is sensuous, is through our touch or through a taste or through hearing or smell or whatever. And part of it is through a human understanding, is through seeing the place as being community. That's one thing that I really wanted to try and get across in the book, and I hope I have done. That's my point about A City of Icebergs, is that what you're seeing is only ever, you know, the small amount, the 10% or whatever it is above the surface. And even if you can't access the 90% beneath, at least be aware of it and at least have an idea that, you know, something that's happening in front of your eyes is not the whole story.
I found the story of your friend fascinating, perhaps one that should have been in the book, but it's already a lengthy book and this would have added even more. So perhaps better just leave it to a podcast. I'm curious about something because you already mentioned a few things here and there. Certainly writing a book about Jerusalem is challenging in many ways. And I was wondering, what kind of challenges did you have to overcome?
Some of the challenges were a sense of where I fit. So I was very aware when I was researching and writing this book of, you know, 150 years, probably more, probably 175, even 200 years of people like me, white, English, well-spoken, relatively well-educated, relatively posh men, in particular men, writing about Jerusalem, or, you know, coming to Jerusalem and claiming it as their own, claiming it for Britain, claiming it for the empire, claiming it for Christianity, if you like. And then writing in detail why their opinion about the place matters so very, very much, and why everybody should listen to them. There are thousands upon thousands upon thousands of books about Jerusalem by people like me from nominally perspectives like mine. I was very aware during the whole process of conceiving and also researching and writing the book that I wanted to try and keep, I could feel those ghosts behind me. I wanted to try and keep them behind me and to be aware of what's gone before and to try, obviously, as much as you can, to try and be different. So that was one challenge. That was significant. The other challenge, I mean, there were a number of different challenges in a number of different directions. Part of it was also political as well, that in wanting to write about Jerusalem, and particularly the people of Jerusalem, it's very important to be able, if you like, to be trusted, to go and make connections with people. And this is common also to journalists working in different places around the world for different reasons as well. It's almost impossible to rock up somewhere, expect to get the true story of the place in a week or two, and to go away and write it, and that's it. It's not impossible to do that. It is possible. Many journalists do that, unfortunately. But you're not, obviously, you're not getting anywhere close to what's actually going on and to what people may actually be feeling and thinking. So a challenge was to try and use the depth of my experience. I would hesitate to put it in quite such grandiose terms as that, but to use the depth of my experience to be able to prove myself reliable, if you like, to the people I was talking to, and for people to be able to want to give me their stories, that's a very complicated process. It's a very difficult process. And also there are things tied up in that as well about, it's also racialized as well, where white people will come in and take other people's, particularly brown or black people's stories, and then use them for their own benefit, use them in their own way. Obviously, I was trying to avoid doing that as much as I could. My purpose was to allow people the space to use their voices as they wish. You know, it's very, that's another thing that I wanted to make clear in this book is that, you know, I'm not giving anybody a voice. People have voices. The people, the Palestinian people in particular in Jerusalem, they have voices and they've been yelling and shouting very, very loud for a very, very long time. And they've not been being listened to. So my purpose was to try and amplify their voices, to use my platform to allow them to speak. That was a significant challenge. I hope I've succeeded. I don't know if I have or not. Maybe you're the best judge of that. But there were a number of challenges. I found it fascinating. The whole process of writing the book was extraordinarily challenging and interesting and absorbing.
The political challenges are obviously some, you know, really something that touch your work, and sometimes they become very personal, because in the end, you know that whatever you're going to write, you may be attacked by one side or another, or at some point there are choices to be made. And I think it's important to, as you said, and I know it as an author writing about particularly Jerusalem, that sometimes it's better to say upfront, you know, where you stand, and then you take it from there, knowing that some readers may be happy and some readers may not be happy about it. Mm-hmm. But let's go back to the book, because you already talked about the question of the quarters. You mentioned that at the very beginning. And really central to the book is the idea of the quarters of a city. Now, today we think about the four quarters of Jerusalem, the Christian, the Jewish, the Armenian, and the Muslim. But the story is a little bit more complicated. And so I was wondering if you can actually complicate the story, telling us what does it mean, a quarter in Jerusalem, and how they developed throughout history.
That's a big question, Roberto. That's a huge question. And there are, you know, I'm not a professional historian, but there are professional historians that will be able to answer it much better than me, but I will do my best. These quarters, I'm going to hold back the idea of what quarter may or may not mean, and how the term stands in this context until the end. Maybe we can talk about it or bring it up again. But I'm going to focus on the actual story of the four quarters in Jerusalem to start with. When I was researching and looking around, as I said, when I was visiting Jerusalem through my 20s and 30s and 40s, I could see that these quarters didn't make sense. There is no line, you know, between the Christian quarter and the Muslim quarter. That line is just a street. It's a market street. It's not particularly wide. It's like 2 or 3 meters wide. There are shops on both sides. There are people on both sides. It's not even both sides, because there's activity moving to and fro. So the idea of a border between one quarter and another, I could see already was false. But then, you know, I wanted to try and understand where the idea came from. I think it's very important the way that we see Jerusalem, how Jerusalem is perceived outside, when it's only ever depicted divided into these four ethno-religiously defined quarters, I think is very important. And I think it affects all sorts of things leading up to, you know, a geopolitical policy on Jerusalem. But I was looking into where they came from. And I would be looking in scholarly works, in academic papers, and other places as well, and they invariably they would be showing the idea of the four quarters having arisen in the 19th century, which we know it's not an ancient thing. It's not something, you know, going back to biblical times or something. It's relatively recent, but they would be defining it as just having sort of arisen spontaneously. At one point in the 19th century, when European outsiders were visiting and exploring Jerusalem more for the first time, the city, how would they put it? Some people would put it that it was just the city was divided into four for the first time. or these quarters just arose. And none of that seemed very satisfying to me. You know, I wanted to know, where did it come from? You can see why. We can talk about why in a minute, but I wanted to know who and where the idea originated with. So I started to look into it, and I started to look at how Jerusalem had been depicted in cartography over the centuries before as well, which is another massive topic. The depiction of Jerusalem, particularly, is this idealized point of contact between heaven and earth, and that sort of that conception of Jerusalem, that idealized conception of Jerusalem, persisted through to, give or take, Napoleon. Napoleon invaded Egypt and then Palestine in 1798 and 99, and with him, as well as military forces, he brought with him a contingent of artists and scholars and scientists and explorers who spread out and began to research, and their findings, you know, sparked this surge of interest in Arab and Turkish culture in Europe, which survives to this day. And we can see that very shortly afterwards, the first maps of Jerusalem start to appear that are not idealized, that are taken from measurements drawn in the field. So the first one is in 1818. And if you have a look at it, this was another bonus of my work, is being able to dig around in old maps, which is just, you know, catnip, marvelous. And you look at this map from 1818, and you can see that the only... There's loads and loads of interest, and you could write a thesis about this particular map just by itself. But the only area within the walls, within the city, that's defined in ethno-religious terms is the Jewish quarter, Judenstadt, as it's named on this map. And that in itself says something. As we move through, you look from there to the next sort of cartographic advance was 1835. There was a map by an English explorer. And again, the only area that's labeled according to this ethno-religious identification is Jewish quarter again. But also, by this time, we start to see areas labeled around the Armenian church and around the Latin church and around the Greek church. These are not quarters, but they are at least identified as areas of Christian settlement. So European outsiders were able to see where Jews were living. But then as time went on, as more people approached and as more people explored, they were able to identify areas of Christian settlement. And then you move on, there's one in 1837, where we start to see quarters for the first time. We see a Turkish quarter, and then we see a Greek quarter, an Armenian quarter, and a Latin quarter, and also a Jewish quarter as well. And as far as I can tell, that point, 1837, is the first time that the idea of quarters appears on a map of Jerusalem. But this period was also a time of political upheaval as well, the 1830s in Jerusalem, but in all of Palestine. There had been a rebellion led from Egypt, which had challenged Ottoman rule. And there was a popular uprising in Palestine as well, which led to a power vacuum. And European powers who were getting engaged with the Ottoman Empire kind of for the first time around this period, well, jockeying for position. They were trying to sort of to exploit the instability for their own purposes, but also to advance their own interests. So this is a period where we see European consulates opening in Jerusalem for the first time. And as part of that as well, particularly thinking about the British, there was an effort by the British to spark a diplomatic initiative using alliances with Prussia and also with Austria-Hungary, I think, as well, in 1839, 1840, to try and calm the political instability down. That failed, and then Britain, as it so often does, went in militarily, and it bombed Palestine effectively into submission in 1840, handed Palestine back to the Ottoman Sultan. At this point, the British consulate was open. But it wasn't as well as the military intervention. What you had, the military remained in place. If you like, there was a contingent of Royal Engineers who stayed following that 1840 bombardment in order to survey terrain. So they were surveying the terrain of the Holy Land. And at the same time, there was a religious, a missionary initiative as well on behalf of Britain. So Britain and other European powers had long viewed the people of the Ottoman Empire as open to evangelizing. And there was a movement in the first half of the 19th century based in London to evangelize the people of the Holy Land in particular. And so what we had in 1842 was the arrival, I'm sort of compressing this story down a bit as well, is the arrival of the first Protestant bishop of Jerusalem from London. With him came a chaplain. And the chaplain's name was George Williams. He was a young man. He was 27 when he arrived in Jerusalem. He only stayed in Jerusalem for about a year. But while he was there, he was researching on with the idea of this with this evangelizing mission behind him. The issue was, it was impossible for Britain to evangelize Muslims because Ottoman law at that time stipulated death for people who converted away from Islam. It was extremely difficult to evangelize Catholics or Orthodox Christians as well, partly because there was no motivation within those communities, but also because France was protecting Catholic rights and Imperial Russia was protecting Orthodox rights. So if you start to mess with the communal balance, then you start to spark another diplomatic row, which Britain was keen to avoid at that time. So partly for those practical reasons, and also partly for broader and wider eschatological reasons too, Britain was focusing all of its evangelizing efforts on the Jews, and particularly on the Jews of Jerusalem. So George Williams was there in order to effect to research the city to find out who lived where. This is why this is what the British wanted to know, was which communities lived in which place in order that they could focus and target their evangelizing efforts. So we see George Williams's book, which comes out a few years later in 1849. Includes a map, and includes the map which is drawn from the Royal Engineers survey, which had been done a few years previously. And this is the map that, for the first time, we see Jerusalem divided into four: Muslim, Christian, Jewish, and Armenian quarters. As far as I can tell, George Williams is the instigator of the four quarters. Before him, maps didn't show them. After him, pretty much every single map that any outside a European or American cartographer makes of Jerusalem includes these four quarters. So there's a direct line from George Williams to the maps and the guidebooks and the news stories and the literature that we all see and use every day today about Jerusalem that shows Jerusalem divided into four. Why have these quarters survived? They've survived. There's a bunch of reasons why. We could go into it. But broadly, in a sentence or two, they've survived because they suit the colonial ambitions of successive waves of rulers of Jerusalem over those 150 plus years since George Williams. Effectively, they divide and rule. And that suited the British outlook pre-colonial times, you know, in the mid and late 19th century. It suited the British mandate from 1917 onwards, and it suits also the Israeli government of today as well. They've persisted, not because they're right, not because they reflect reality, which they don't, but they've persisted for political and geopolitical reasons, which I find now to be spurious. That's a very, very, very long-winded answer to the idea of quarters. We talked a little bit earlier about what quarter means. There's a section which I go into in the book as well about the use and the nuances behind the word quarter, where quarter came from. Quarter originated in Latin. It came from the division of a Roman military camp into four by the creation of a north-south road and an east-west road. And the quarters in a Roman camp would be given over to different units or different designations, whatever. But there are military, at least in English, there are military nuances that survive behind the word quarter, we think of quartermaster, is a military a department that looks after supplies, to give no quarter to an enemy. Even just the word headquarters has a military origin to it as well. There are many other examples too. The word is not a neutral word, and it's quite telling that it's used still today. It survives most often in municipal gentrification schemes. If a municipality, and I think this would be the same in Britain or in America or even in other places too that are non-English, when a municipality wants to sort of revivify a rundown area of their city, they'll maybe try and do it up a bit or whatever, and they'll resell it as the garden quarter, the riverside quarter, the canal quarter, or they'll choose a historical word or something. The idea of quarter is not neutral, and the idea of who lives in a quarter is very, very complex. I go into it a little bit in the book, but I'm also fascinated by that, and I feel that there may actually be another book just in the word quarter alone, but maybe not straight away.
Let me say a couple of things here. One is that your narrative certainly point out to the fact that this division in four quarters is artificial, and you know the map and the story of the map that you discuss in the book really shows how this came about for all sorts of reasons. And I also want to highlight that for those who are interested, there's a very fascinating article by Michel Campos who looked at the quarters of Jerusalem rely on GIS technology for the late Ottoman era. And essentially, the findings are suggesting that, yes, there were clusters where people lived together, in terms of religion or ethnicity. But effectively, the old quarters of the cities were all mixed. And so we have this kind of like dichotomy where, yes, there are certainly areas with a majority of either Christian or Muslim, of Jews or Armenians, but it also shows the fact that there were properties inhabited by individuals belonging to different religious groups, and they all shared the quarter. So,
and I think that's a key point, that idea of exclusivity that hangs around in the shadows of the word quarter, I think is also very relevant in this context too. I think even very simplistically, when I was visiting myself as a tourist, when you look at the map and you see a Muslim quarter, say, if you're not Muslim and you're approaching Jerusalem, which is a holy city, you know, with all this baggage attached to it as well, and you see Muslim quarter, it's not so much of a leap to imagine that that's exclusive and that non-Muslims maybe can't enter or shouldn't enter or can't live there or have never lived there or shouldn't live there. It's the way that we think of quarters and the way that quarters communicate or translate the city for outside consumption, I think is very relevant. And you know, you're absolutely right, Michelle, and other historians as well, apart from Michelle Campos, have written very evocatively and importantly about the mixed and cosmopolitan nature of Jerusalem during the Ottoman period and before as well. When I was doing my research, I came across a historian who had written about 39 quarters, if you like, or neighborhoods of Jerusalem in the 13th, 14th century, and a very famous Jerusalemite historian, Mujahid ad-Din, in 1495, describes 18 quarters of the city. You know, these were organic neighborhoods that had arisen from the bottom up. They weren't like George Williams's quarters imposed from the top down. And I think that difference is crucial.
Now, your book is a book of history, but also of contemporary issues. In fact, it's a book that merges both historical narratives with interviews of Jerusalemites. Now, in this second part of the interview, I really want to focus on a few stories that are discussed in the book. And I would like you to perhaps take us through a sort of a virtual tour of the city. And I would like to start with Damascus Gate, Bab al-Hamut, and where this gate leads to.
That's a really interesting idea. Wow. The trouble is, I mean, I'm very happy to do it, and we can talk about it for sure. The trouble is, it's going to get very complicated because Jerusalem has, you know, 10,000 alleyways, and they all lead in different directions, and they've all got stories attached to them. Not all of which I know, clearly, not all of which are in the book. But yeah, we can start for sure at Damascus Gate, which is this, which is the main entrance to the Old City from East Jerusalem, from majority Palestinian areas. And as you approach, it's this very, very imposing, tall, battlemented gateway. The walls stretch either side. These are the walls which were built by the Ottoman Sultan Suleiman in the 1537 to 1541. And they're still extant as he left them as well today. You approach through this gateway. There's a dog leg which you do inside the gateway in order to get on, to move ahead, which was a defensive tactic, so that if an approaching hostile force approaches the gateway, they have to turn sharp left and then turn immediately sharp right in order to enter, which exposes them to further attack and whatever. As you enter, you're thrown immediately into the heart of the souk, into the heart of the marketplace. There are stalls on both sides, and the steps, the street is stepped, so the steps in front of you lead down, and there are hawkers shouting on both sides, you know, the latest price for this or a cheap price for that. Often on the steps, kind of at the foot of shoppers, will be women sitting, usually older women, often dressed in country clothes. These are women who will have come into Jerusalem from, or quite often from, the villages around Bethlehem, just to the south, and they will bring with them vegetables or herbs or different condiments, or whatever that they will have made or grown on their farm or produced themselves or by their neighbors or whatever, to sell on the streets of Jerusalem. There's a whole story with them as well, because what they do is illegal. So in order to enter Jerusalem and to come through the military checkpoints that are controlled by the Israeli army that surround Jerusalem, they have to do various, they have to make various subterfuges, whatever. I refer to that in the book as well. But there's this, it's a hive of activity all around you. There's buying and selling going on everywhere. As you come down the steps, in front of you is a very, very nice falafel restaurant, which has been there for many years, many decades. And the main street splits to left and right. So to the right, the souk, the main part of the souk, continues. And it just a very, very slightly a rising gradient. And it continues. It's called Souk Khan al-Zayt. A khan is a caravanserai. Zayt means oil, in this case, olive oil, all the way along here. For many centuries past, olive oil was stored and was processed either for cooking or often into soap, olive oil soap. Nowadays, it's more of a general market. It's a market of coffee and I don't know, sports shoes and kitchenware and stationery and jewelry and I don't know, amazing Arabic sweets and I don't know what, a thousand things. Moving along this street, that rises and eventually reaches the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which we can come to in a minute. If you take the other direction from that amazing falafel shop at the bottom of the steps from Damascus Gate, that's a famous street called El Wad, which means the valley, and that leads down. So the gradient is dropping down slightly, and you follow that. Again, it's part of the souk. There's an amazing sweet shop on the left, selling little sweets and candies for kids. There's I don't know off the top of my head. There's a pastry shop, and there's a shoe shop, and there's other places, and there's a pharmacy. And as you continue down on the left, there's a big wall. Which hides the garden of the Austrian Hospice, which was built in the mid-19th century by the Diocese of Austria as one of the lodges that European powers were building for their pilgrims to visit Jerusalem. And it still survives today. It was a hospital for a long time. Now it's a guest house. It's quite an upmarket, quite posh guest house with a lovely roof, terrace, and a very nice cafe where they sell Viennese coffee and Sachertorte and all sorts of things. There are 1,000 places we could go from here as well. We'll continue straight along Alwad Street. You go past, on the left are the third and the fourth stations of the cross. The first and second are up the way slightly and just sort of up to the left where we are. And this is part of the Via Dolorosa, which is the traditional route followed by Jesus as he carried the cross from his judgment place to Calvary. Did he walk this route? Probably not. It's a tradition which arose over the centuries, a bit of creative visualization. He was probably not judged where the first station of the cross currently is. He was probably judged over on the other side of the city. Whatever. This is a metaphysical journey, if you like, that's only rooted to the physical street by these points of religious and spiritual interest. So we pass the third and the fourth station, and then we come to an amazing hummus restaurant called Abu Shukri, very famous, which has been there also for years and years and years.
And what is interesting is that really your narrative...
I can keep going, Roberto, for hours and hours.
And the beauty of it is that really you get the sense reading your book of a living city. So there is the history all around. But one thing that I found fascinating, again, about your narrative is that you can actually get into the city itself and somehow experiencing from just through, you know, the pages of the book. And there's another
nice
location.
Of you to say. Thank you.
There's another location I want you to talk about because this is very interesting, challenging, and also very problematic, which is the area around Dung Gate, so another part of the city. Now, the area around Dung Gate essentially is connected with a story of a Mughrabi quarter. Now, for contemporary visitors, the Mughrabi quarter does no longer exist. This was a quarter that stood there for centuries, but in 1967 was literally razed to the ground after the Israeli conquered the old city of Jerusalem. Can you tell us a little bit more about this?
Yes, I can. It's the chapter of the book, really, that I guess I was most proud of. I think telling this story is very important, and it's not told enough. I was very lucky to meet somebody who was able to sort of unlock the story for me. She is a lady called Maysoon al-Maslahi. Her family, she's Palestinian, but her family originates from Morocco and Algeria, and has long been involved in caretaking of mosques in particular, or holy places. And she still looks after one of the only buildings that is still extant from the old Moroccan / North African quarter as it was pre-1967. Just on the edge of what was that, the area of that quarter, there is a building which survives behind an anonymous door. It's not usually open to the public. I was very, very lucky to be able to meet her and to gain access. There's a little courtyard there, which is the building is looked after by a Moroccan Waqf, the Ministry of Islamic Affairs of Morocco, and there's half a dozen families live in this small around this small courtyard, and up above is a small mosque which holds a tomb, which is the focus of Maysoon's care and attention. So she looks after the mosque and she looks after the tomb, and she tries to keep the memory of that quarter alive. The tomb dates, we don't know exactly. I'm not sure that any serious investigation has been done of the tomb. It dates back probably to the 14th century. It's given on the shroud that covers the tomb, it's given as being the tomb of Abu Madian, who is reputed to be the founder of that quarter in Jerusalem. Abu Madian is a very well-known Sufi mystical Islamic master from that period, from the 14th and the late 13th and 14th century. It may be his tomb. It may be more likely to be his grandson, perhaps, or another associated figure. But that is the origin of this area of Jerusalem that now no longer exists. It was founded following Salah ad-Din's recapture of Jerusalem from the Crusaders. which was in 1187. And in the years following that, reputedly, legendarily, as a gesture of gratitude, this area, beside what is the Western Wall, it is the Western Wall, but beside the long retaining westernmost wall of the Al-Aqsa compound, this area was given to Moroccan and North African fighters who fought with Salah ad-Din. This is the story. And within a few decades following that, we have documentary evidence of endowments, land endowments in this area, which tie to either Abu Madian or Abu Madian's grandson and others, like I say, other associated figures. So this area had a long tradition in Moroccan and North African culture. From then, there were mosques, there were homes and other buildings of different kinds. From then all the way through to the late 19th century and early 20th century. But because this area was where it was always a focus of attention. It's located directly, as I said, directly in front of the Western Wall. So up till 1967, the area that was open for Jews to pray at the Western Wall was a relatively narrow alleyway, which had been opened by the Sultan Suleiman in the 16th century as part of a process of refocusing and redirecting Jewish public observance in Jerusalem. He was not shutting them out, he was welcoming them in, and he wanted to move Jewish observance from outside the city, where the Jews used to gather outside the Golden Gate and also on the Mount of Olives. And instead, for reasons to do with economy and politics, he wanted to welcome them into the city and to integrate them as an element of the migrant economy in Jerusalem at that time. And he opened this alleyway in front of the Western Wall, behind the Moroccan North African Quarter. So that situation persisted right the way through. But in the late 19th century, you've written about this as well, Roberto, and other people have written about this as well. In the late 19th century, at the end of the Ottoman Empire and the early 20th century, there was a lot of focus from particularly European Zionist Jews seeking to expand the Jewish presence and the Jewish area in front of the Western Wall. There was a lot of focus on what was deemed and often dismissed as slum housing of the Moroccan Quarter, with attempts to buy it, to whatever, with efforts to expropriate this area in order to expand Jewish worship. All of them failed for different reasons. And then we got to 1967 when Israel invaded and occupied the old city. And within 2 days of the Israeli army presence in Jerusalem at that time, a plan was put together to fulfill those ideas that had been knocking around for several decades before, to simply expropriate the area of the Moroccan Quarter and to raise it to the ground, which is what happened on the evening of June the 10th, 1967. Men with sledgehammers went in first, and then bulldozers followed during the night. And by morning, most of the work had already been done. It went on for another 24 hours or so, and the area was reduced to rubble and completely cleared. And there were deaths. There was a woman who we understand also Maysoon tells this story as well, that she was deaf, and so she didn't hear the banging and the shouting and all the commotion that evening. So she stayed in her house when everybody else around her was fleeing and leaving as quickly as they could. She stayed in her house, and her house was demolished around her. There were also testimony from Israeli army officers and engineers who were present at the time as well, that more bodies were found after this operation, and some were removed. And there's a report by one of the engineers that says some were simply not, and they were just bulldozed into the ground, into the dirt, in front of the Western Wall, which was then paved over and is now the plaza that we see today. It's a shocking story. It's an awful story. It's a story that hasn't been told enough, certainly not in English, and is not a story that's visible at all when you're in the place. There's no plaque, there's no sign, there's no evidence that this huge, vast plaza in front of the Western Wall was anything but a plaza. Memory is bulldozed as well, if you like. And I'm proud of this chapter in this book for being one tiny effort to keep that memory alive on Maysoon's behalf as well, and the people around Maysoon.
And this is a very important chapter, as you mentioned. The story of the Mughrabi Quarter, I mean, did not end in 1967, but it continues with the people that eventually were displaced after those Absolutely. Events. And in a sense, for different reasons, the Mughrabi Quarter came to be once again, sort of in the news headline when some excavations were made around the area, and eventually archaeologists found material connected to the Mughrabi Quarter and not to earlier period. And so many people then realized that actually there was a Mughrabi Quarter up until 1967, so not exactly a long time ago.
No, exactly. And even if we're thinking about the same excavation, people found coins, Jordanian era coins from the 1950s and 1960s that had been left. People were so desperate to run away from their homes because of these sledgehammers and the bulldozers coming in that they dropped money even. You know, they weren't even didn't even have enough time to pick up all their possessions. The finding of the coins was particularly poignant, I thought.
Absolutely. Now, it is impossible really to ask about all of the stories in your book, but the last one I want to ask about is the story of a community, I would say widely neglected, which is the community of the Afro-Palestinians. Who are they? Mm. How did they come to Jerusalem? And how they fit your narrative?
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting story. As you say, it's also widely unknown as well. I was, I was very happy to use the platform that I've got to be able to give this a little bit of a boost. This is a community today numbering about 450 people who are Muslim and who claim their origins from different parts of West and Central Africa. And they live in a small community right at the gates of Al-Aqsa in a place called Bab al-Majlis in two little compounds across a narrow alleyway from each other, right next to the gateway into the mosque. Their history is very long and very complicated. It's a difficult and it's not a straightforward topic to try and summarize. Broadly, there is the conversion or the acceptance of Islam in West Africa is dated to around the 11th century, the early part of the 11th century, in an area called Takrur, which is, as far as is understood, is where Senegal and Mauritania, modern-day Senegal and modern-day Mauritania, meet. And the history of the African Palestinian community today in Jerusalem, with breaks and with difficulties caused often by lack of documentary evidence. There's plenty of oral evidence, but often documentary evidence is lacking. Links back from today, back in some way or other, back to Takrur. The communities, if you talk to them today, tend to claim four origin points in particular. They claim Senegal, Nigeria, Chad, and Sudan. And looking into that as well, I seem to be able to uncover the idea that Sudan, as it's understood now, may not always just relate to the Republic of Sudan, the south of Egypt that we know today. Sudan is a difficult and complicated term, which may and in colonial times, in French colonial times, referred to a whole area, a swathe of sort of West and Central Africa. So it may be that the origin in Sudan is not linked necessarily specifically to the state that we know today, but it's linked to this much larger area. Broadly, often African Muslim pilgrims would come to Jerusalem, often after the Hajj to Mecca, from the 15th century in larger numbers, and sometimes people would stay. And so people would, as is familiar, people would cluster, as we've talked about before, would cluster in certain areas. And one of the areas that African Muslim people were known to have gathered in was this area, which is still populated today at Bab al-Majlis, under the Ottoman rulers. People who stayed were often given jobs in security and policing, in either policing the gateways into the mosque to make sure that non-Muslims didn't enter, or to provide security for the Muslim religious institutions and teaching institutions that were gathered around the walls of Al-Aqsa. And that persisted right the way through to the 19th century, and even beyond into the early 20th century. By the time, right at the end of the Ottoman Empire in the 1900s and 1910s, these two compounds are known as a prison. So they were the main prison of Jerusalem. One sort of across this alleyway, one side of the alleyway was a prison for people who were held on remand or people with shorter sentences. And across the way, across the alleyway, the other compound was for people who had life sentences, or often death sentences. Exactly when that transition occurred from civilian security guards to a prison, I don't know. I've not been able to find out. The sources that I've looked at don't specify exactly when that transition occurred. It occurred at some point before the late 19th, early 20th centuries. When the British arrived in 1917, they cleared the prison out and they moved the prison outside the walls of the city. But then that relation of African Muslim communities in Jerusalem to security persisted. The bodyguards of the Mufti of Jerusalem, Amin al-Husseini, at this time were African. And in return for protecting him, he was a rebellious figure who was often in conflict with the British authorities. In return for protecting him, the African communities were granted the right to resettle in this area that had been the prison, in these old compounds that had been persisting for centuries. And so that tradition is maintained to this day. So there are African communities there now, which often consist of, again, pilgrims who will have visited Jerusalem after performing the Hajj and who then will have stayed on. And there are various stories among the community of particular figures who made this move and then settled. And often there's now intermarriage. So there are also concerns among the community as well that although they maintain a clear sense of their own identity themselves within their own community, there is a sense that the wider identity is being lost because of intermarriage and because of integration with the wider Palestinian community. There are lots of very fascinating social and political ramifications to the presence of this particular community, these people here. It's a really fascinating story. I was delighted to come across it, and I was delighted to be able to tell it in the best way that I could.
I have one last question, and I just want to go back to the very beginning. So after writing the book, did your view about Jerusalem change somehow?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, my view of Jerusalem has changed almost minute by minute sometimes, but certainly, you know, from year to year. So the my view of Jerusalem when I visited when I was, you know, 11 and 12 and 13 is quite different from how I view the city now. As you know, each time that I go back, like I said early on, I've had this enormous privilege because of the passport that I carry and because of the color of my skin and various other privileges that I have, the language that I speak, that I've been able to, in a sense, measure myself against Jerusalem. So as I have changed, as I've grown from a child to an adult, and as my thoughts and outlooks and political sensibilities, whatever, have changed over the years, I've been very lucky to be able to go back and back and back to Jerusalem and to see how I have changed in relation to it and how it changes in relation to me. So for sure, writing this book has changed my view of Jerusalem. Writing this book was a liberation for me, to be able to say this stuff, you know, to have had this stuff inside for so long, if you like, all my life. And to be able to sort of, I don't know how to put it, to weigh my words, you know, carefully enough over the years and the decades in order to come out with something that I know to be right according to my criteria, and I know to be good according to my criteria, was a liberation. Was, yeah, it was absolutely liberating, and it was, it made me feel different about myself, but it also made me feel different about Jerusalem as well. That understanding that the people were able to give to me, were so willing, you know, and generous to give to me, certainly has changed my view of Jerusalem, and has, you know, deepened my understanding of the place, but has also deepened my understanding of the political context in which it sits, has deepened my understanding of the social, the wider social context of Palestine and Israel. And without wanting to get, you know, too purple about it, has also deepened my understanding of humanity as well. This has been an extraordinary experience writing this book. I've loved every minute of it.
This was Matthew Teller, author of Nine Quarters of Jerusalem, a new biography of the old city, published by Profile Books in 2022. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, Roberto. It's been a pleasure.